In Hollywood, there is an exclusive school that is attended by children of movie stars, producers, and directors. Once, a teacher asked her class to write a composition on the subject of poverty. One little girl turned in her literary piece, and it started this way. Once, there was a poor little girl. Her father was poor. Her mother was poor. Her governess was poor. Her chauffeur was poor. Her butler was poor. In fact, everybody in that great big house was very, very poor. Is that sad or is that funny? I don't know. But I think it's true that we live in big houses with lots of things, and we're still poor. Lynn Twist, in her book, The Soul of Money, shares with us that her belief is that all of our conversations, our waking and our rising, are dominated by what we don't have and what we still want to get. She says that we swim in conversations about where there isn't enough. Often, she says, our first waking thought of the day is, you can probably say this with me, I didn't get enough sleep. And the next is, I won't have enough time today. And that the thought of not enough happens to us all throughout the rest of the day. We don't have enough time. We don't have enough rest. We don't get enough exercise. We don't have enough profits, enough power, enough freedom. And we can shift the semantics just a little bit and talk about how we're not smart enough, pretty enough, thin enough, fit enough, educated enough, successful enough. Before we even sit up in bed in morning and before our feet touch the floor, she says, we are already feeling inadequate, already feeling our inadequacy, already feeling like we are lacking something. And nowhere, she says, does that scarcity mentality play out more than it does with our money. William Wordsworth said, the world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we lay waste to our power. I told you a couple of weeks back that when I taught high school sophomores, I used to joke that I could tell the exact day that a student turned 16. Their whole attitude seemed to shift as they reached that milestone of independence and autonomy, getting a driver's license. And many times, when that independence and autonomy started showing up in declining grades, incomplete homework, tired and distracted students, I'd ask them about it. And I was saddened when so many of them told me, without ever hearing the irony of it, that they were now working so they could get a car. They needed a car, they assured me. Why? I asked. So I can get to work. Now, here's what that might look like to an adult, again, from Lynn Twist, The Soul of Money. She said, we caught ourselves in that scramble for more. The money was flowing in, everything was acquired or used, and everything we acquired or used the money for led to the desire for the next thing, the next purchase, the next reason to buy more. To be socially literate, we felt we needed to learn about fine wine. And when we did, we needed a wine cellar. We bought a fast, hot sports car. And then remembered we needed room for the children. So we bought a station wagon. We had a wonderful house, but somehow it didn't seem finished without some sort of impressive art. And as soon as we learned about art, we wanted to buy more expensive art. And our friends started building summer homes, so we needed a summer home. And then our clothes needed to be new, and our shoes needed to be new to match our new clothes, and our coats needed to be new to match our new clothes and our new shoes. And the list of upgrades was endless. Now, they've got a lot of money, probably more money than you or I have. But that doesn't mean that the same scenario isn't played out in our lives, maybe on a smaller scale. I have to work more to provide more for my kids, whom I don't see because I'm working more. Because here's the thing about that scarcity mindset. We can let go of it. We can willingly, mindfully let go of it and start to live not in scarcity, but in sufficiency. Lynn Twist points out that by sufficiency, she doesn't just mean a step or two up from poverty or one step under abundance. It isn't a measure of barely enough or more than enough. Sufficiency isn't an amount at all. It's an experience. Living in enough is an experience. Not only do we realize that we have enough, we begin to realize that we are enough. Sufficiency, she says, resides in each of us, and we can call it up. We can call it forth. It's a consciousness, an attention, an intentional choosing of the way that we think about our circumstances. And it's not just money. It's everything. It's everything that we take part in. You know, when we decided to bring back the 6:24 service on Saturday nights, I was so excited, but I found as we got closer and closer to the first one, I was sick at my stomach. I was just so ill at ease about it, this big thing. And I had, well, we don't have enough people that somebody can be at the door to be the security, and we don't have enough people to be outside to make sure people know which building to go to. We don't have enough people to set up all the different things, and I'm not sure we have enough people to do the lights and the sound and all the things that need to be done. And I was literally sick. Until about the third service. And I woke up that morning, and I was sick of being sick. And it came to me in the course of that morning, you are focused on the wrong things. 3 months ago, you didn't even have a singer for the Saturday night service. And now you have an amazing young woman and her partner with Hearts for God who can sing, who can play, who can handle every piece of technical equipment you got. And you are focused on the wrong things. And then I began to look forward to it. And I wasn't sick about it anymore. And nothing had changed but what I was focused on. Now, here's the thing about moving out of scarcity and into sufficiency, into enough. You would think that the church would be a great place for us to learn that lesson. That the church would be all about teaching us not to live in scarcity, to live in abundance. Well, Jesus was good at that, but the church isn't. A woman named Maggie Harmon did some research on generosity in the church and why people give and their understanding of how much they have or not. And this is what she said. Maggie Harmon said, people respond to request for giving for two purposes. One, it brings pleasure, or two, it avoids pain. People will part with their money to bring pleasure to themselves or to avoid pain. Unfortunately, she says, the history of giving in the church is related to the second reason. Why do you give to your church? To avoid the suffering or punishment of the afterlife. The church has taught that lesson for centuries. You know that, right? But not so very long ago, we decided to flip that script. And then you started hearing that, no, you're not giving your money as a ticket to get out of hell. You're doing it because it's going to support something great. Because we're partners in caring for God's creation. Well, that script doesn't flip that easily. It takes some time to help people understand that our giving is in response to God's giving, to God's goodness. Our giving is a response to all the things that we can be invited to do in the world. I'm going to take us back to the scripture, and I'm going to talk about the lessons that we can learn from David about scarcity and abundance and giving and enough. That day, Gad came to David and said to him, go up and erect an altar to the Lord on the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite. Following Gad's instructions, David went up as the Lord had commanded. Here's the first thing. David was doing God's will. David was sure about that. David was doing God's will. We know the scripture. We cannot serve two masters. We cannot serve God and money. David was serving God. You knew I couldn't get past using my favorite quote one more time, so this is the last time you have to hear it, but this is my thing here. Lewis Lapham, money is like fire, an element as little troubled by moralizing as earth, air, and water. Humans can employ it as a tool, or they can dance around it as if it were the incarnation of a god. It acquires its meaning from the uses to which it is put. And when Araunah looked down, he saw the king and his servants coming toward him. And Araunah went out and prostrated himself before the king with his face to the ground. Araunah said, why has my lord the king come to his servant? And David said, to buy the threshing floor from you in order to build an altar to the Lord so that the plague may be averted from the people. Why are you here, David? What is your purpose? I am here to buy the threshing floor. I'm here to part with my money in order to build an altar to God so that the plague may be averted from the people. How many of us have that much purpose behind our spending, behind our buying, behind our pursuit? Lynn Twist, the soul of money, you know, her life-changing moment was when she became part of the Hunger Project, a project that says to the world, there is enough right now, enough resources to end hunger. Lynn Twist started working with the Hunger Project, and this is what she said. As I began to work with the Hunger Project, I began to understand my own inner hunger and the inauthentic and inappropriate way that we were living. It was then that we purposely began to turn our resources, our money, our time, our energy, the accumulation of material wealth, toward our longing to make a difference with our lives. Purpose. We begin to use our time, our energy, our money, and the accumulation of material wealth to make a difference with our lives. And further, she said, when we began to work with the Hunger Project, I realized that I myself was suffering from another kind of hunger. The hunger to live a life of meaning. Then Arana said to David, let my lord the king take and offer up what seems good to him. Here are the oxen for the burnt offering and the threshing sledges and the yokes of the oxen for the wood. All this, O king, Arana gives to the king. And Arana said to the king, may the Lord your God respond favorably to you. But the king said to Arana, no, but I will buy them from you for a price. I will not offer burnt offerings to the Lord my God. That cost me nothing. Do you remember when you were a little child and you were sitting beside your parents in church, and if you're as old as I am, they handed you a dime. If you're a little bit younger, they handed you a quarter. If you're a lot younger, handed you a dollar. And sometimes, like I remember Al saying one time, I wasn't quite sure I wanted to put it in the offering. David's saying that. I don't want you to give me what I'm going to give back to God. I'm not going to give to God what cost me nothing. I haven't been able to get those words out of my mind this last week, including last night when I was here watching the Austin Gay Men's Chorus. That was a fun time. And as much as I was enjoying singing, I was even singing when I wasn't supposed to, Daniel, when the words weren't up there. And at one time, I almost caught myself wanting to get up and dance, but I stopped that in time. But I was sitting here and I knew today was coming, I couldn't get those words out of my head. I will not give back to God what cost me nothing. And then I heard these men start to speak about the Austin Gay Men's Chorus and what it costs some of them to even join the chorus, what it costs some of them to come out. And then I started thinking about us here and what it has cost some of us to build this building, to create this community, and so many people who came before us, what it cost them to be the first 12 to worship together in an apartment. What it cost them to change the name legally of their church so that banks and realtors would work with them because they wouldn't work with a gay church. What it cost us when we decided we had this big audacious dream to build this building. It cost us people who said, you don't have a clear plan. It cost us people who said, you don't need more room. It cost us sleep. It cost us health. It cost us money. And I was thinking about all that last night, and I was sitting here and I was watching those men, and I was thinking how cool it was that our community and their community are such natural allies, and how amazing it was that these people right here that nobody gave a chance, these people right here who people said, you can't be Christian and be gay, those people and our allies sitting here, we built this building. And you know what I heard several times last night? A big thank you to MCC Austin, who gave us this great, big, wonderful building, completely rent-free, for a whole week of rehearsals and two concerts. And the people applauded. What it took to build this building, which was used by the Austin Gay Men's Chorus, whose mission is to change minds, transform lives, build community. Ha! That's the trifecta. And before the show, a man came up to me and he said, Reverend Thompson, I'm part of the Austin Coalition on Aging. And I just want to thank your church so much for hosting the Golden Generation. Lunch and social activities for the LGBT community and our allies. And this week I found out that, have you been keeping up with what's going on in AISD? That the AISD is talking about bringing in a new sex education curriculum. And the moral majority, the conservative wing, has organized. They brought people in from outside of Austin. They're well organized. They're well trained. They speak well. They hold up their signs. They don't want the words gay. They don't want any discussion of gender identity, transgender, nothing in the new curriculum. They want to keep us back in the dark ages. Well, there's a group called Informed Parents who is raising the opposite side of that discussion. Parents of trans kids, gay kids, gender nonconforming kids, questioning kids, they needed a place to organize too. Because HRC is going to train them in advance of the next AISD school board meeting, going to teach them how to talk, going to help them make posters, going to get them right so they can raise their voices too. Where are they going to meet? Where does that many people meet? They're going to meet here. They're going to meet here. Your gifts, your money, your energy, your time, it's making a difference. It's making a difference. A couple weeks ago, I said, money is like water. Gertrude told us from some folks, it rushes through their life like a raging river. Money comes through my life a little like a little trickle. But I want to pass it on in a way that does the most good for the most folks. I see it as my right and as my responsibility. It is also my joy. And then I told you, money is like fire. That used carelessly, it can destroy us, but used wisely, it can warm us in the winter, cook our food, light the darkness, forge steel. Money is like fire. There's enough for every single person who needs light, warmth, and energy. Money is like fire. It leaves a trail. Just as wildfire burns a visible path, so does our money. That your bank account, your credit card receipts will show you where you've used the power of your money. And so I thought I should finish up by telling you that money is like air. But it's not. Unless you make it that way. Unless you understand that there is enough. There is more than enough. You don't spend time fretting about the air. You don't spend time fretting about having enough air, about storing it away. Yet in 3 minutes without air, you will die. It's time to repair our relationship with money. To let it serve us rather than us serving it. To use it with purpose. To celebrate having enough. The last thing I'm going to say to you today is from my son, who is now even wiser than he was when he left for college 5 weeks ago. He sent us a family text. Here's where I want to be with money. I've been a college student for 5 weeks, and I've already reached the stage of adulthood where I get really excited about buying a slightly better brand of peanut butter than my usual because I've got some extra spending money. We can live in scarcity, or we can live in enough. That choice is ours. Amen.